The Vinny White Show on In-Depth Radio, News Talk 1010.
Good evening. How are you? Nice to be here on a Sunday night. 9:06 is your time if you're listening in the Eastern Standard Time Zone, wherever that may be. And then, plus and minus an hour each way, really. Apart from Newfoundland, who I believe some of the year just hang out a half hour different to everyone else, don't they? Always that little bit different than Newfies, in a positive and groovy way. 416-872-1010, if you'd like to call in, no matter where you're from. And you can text the show on 71010. You can also press StarTalk 8255 if you have the means. And there's other things you can do to get in touch, like, I don't know, Facebook. What do you think of that? It's like 2014. I've got a hover car here. So if you want to do that, my name is Vinny White. I mean, my name's Vinny White in reality, but I also chose the same one for Facebook and Twitter for fairly logical reasons, although the spelling is fairly absurd. V-I-N-N-E-Y White is the name. So that's that out of the way. Now, what on earth is this, I hear you say? Well, it's a radio show is what we got here, and I'll find one at that. I mean, usually it's fairly mediocre, but I feel like tonight's going to be exceptional, and I genuinely mean that. We're speaking to a man who I've always wanted to talk to ever since I heard his story. Mike Spencer Bown is a gentleman who has visited 195-ish countries. And yes, that's every country in the world. So I can't see how he could possibly be uninteresting. That would be quite amazing, wouldn't it, if we brought him on and he was just like, "Oi, yeah, I like hills. Grass is nice." I'm not quite sure exactly what he will be saying, but I'm desperate to ask him a multitude of questions. And perhaps you are too. So if you have any questions for Mike, the most travelled man on this earth, very likely, although not definitely, it's very hard to conclude these things, but I think we can be fairly confident that he's travelled a hell of a lot more than anyone I've ever met. If you'd like to ask him questions, you can text your questions to 71010. And don't text, "What was your favourite country?" Because if that's him, I'm sure that's the most boring question. Although, let's be honest, I probably will ask it. So text your questions to a man that has done more travel than possibly anyone else ever in the history of time, which is a phenomenal title to have. And one that, from the brief amount of radio work that I've heard him do, he's very humble about. In fact, I think he's a very humble gentleman. But then I'm not sure how you could travel the world and mix with so many cultures and live with pygmies in Papua New Guinea, for example, and not come out the other end being quite a humble and reasonable Zen-like dude. So I'm really looking forward to speaking to him. That's that. We're on till 10. There'll be some other stuff as well. If we get time, I want to talk about how recently, in a bid to get more votes, the EU, the European Union, has done a rap battle. Rap music has, particularly of late, been very much associated with, well, crime in many respects, and certainly, skimming the corners off the laws here and there, yeah? Bitches and hoes and things like that, was, I believe, are some of the lyrics. And as you can tell from my accent, I'm from Brooklyn, New York. It's got a bit of a... gangster rapper particularly has got a bit of a reputation for being unwholesome. Well, the EU have fixed that up because they use rap to try and encourage votes. Yes, four teams, each made up of politicians and professional freestyle hip-hop artists, took to the stage in Brussels, and the results are absolutely hilarious. I don't think they were supposed to be hilarious, but they are absolutely hilarious. Which is the best kind of hilarious, isn't it? It's the audio version of watching a bald fat man fall over on ice. It shouldn't be funny, and it wasn't supposed to be, but it is really funny. Okay. So let's get on with the show. First of all, I wanted to talk about this chap who we talked about last week, the popular televangelist, who you may remember has proclaimed that the end of the world is nigh again. I think you lose your right to predict the end of the world if you've already predicted it and it didn't happen. But idiotic, vulnerable people will be idiotic, vulnerable people that will put these people in positions of power and actually make occasionally more idiotic, vulnerable people believe in their ridiculous claims. We're talking, by the way, about the best-selling author and televangelist, Pastor John Hagee, who claims the four blood moons that have appeared this week, the beginning of a world-shaking event. Always good to be specific. Thanks for that. The blood moons are part of a tetrad, a set of complete and consecutive lunar eclipses that began on April the 15th, as queued. Well done, you. According to NASA, it's just a fairly regular thing to happen. Well, I mean, it's rare, but the skies have been tetrad-free from 1600 to 1900, but there'll be quite a few over the next sort of year and a half. The most unique thing about the 2014-2015 tetrad is that all of them will be visible from every single part of the USA, which, again, NASA have said is perfectly normal, albeit rare and exciting, whereas this guy, who owns a multi-million dollar corporation slash church, really no difference between the two, as far as I can see in this case, says that it's no coincidence. For him, it's a sign of end times. And we played some of his stuff last week, his predictions on how this is the beginning of the end. And you get this every year. I mean, you get this every few months, doesn't it? Depending who you listen to. If I walked outside now and went up to the fellow that lives on the corner that wears a tin hat, he'd probably predict it this week. But if apparently you give someone an unreasonable amount of money for doing an unreasonable amount of nothing, then people start listening to them. Which means that if I want more listeners, I better get rich. Because I'm not doing very well at all. Regardless, let's hear what he said about the end times and see if now that the tetrads have begun this week, he's made it any clearer as to what on earth is going on.
John Hagee, in his book called Four Blood Moons, evangelical pastor John Hagee writes that this unusual lunar event is foretold in the Bible and signals big changes are in store for mankind. He joins us now on the phone, and I would like to add that Pastor Hagee would be live with us on camera were it not for his recent knee surgery. Thank you so much for joining us, sir.
Thank you. It's my pleasure to be with you.
You know, for folks who may not understand what this represents to you and many other Christians, explain for us, if you will, why you believe the blood moon offers up a spiritual connection to biblical prophecy.
I do, because the Bible so clearly says that. Joel, the second chapter, verse 30 through 31 states, "And I will show wonders in the heavens. The sun shall be turned into darkness." That's a solar eclipse. "And the moon into blood," that's a lunar eclipse, "before the coming of the great and awesome day of the Lord." From the beginning of the Bible, in Genesis 1:14, God says, "Let there be lights in the heavens, and let them be for signs and seasons." The Hebrew word for sign means signal. If God is sending a signal, he obviously is sending it to us. This very clearly implies that God is using the sun, the moon, and the stars to send signals to us on the earth. King David continues the thought in Psalms 19, 1 and 2, by saying, "The heavens declare the glory of the Lord." The word declare means to speak. "Day unto day they utter speech, and night unto night it utters knowledge." King David is clearly saying that the heavens are God's billboard through which he is communicating to man.
Although he didn't say that, but he's clearly saying that if you interpret it. Yeah, a man that's made millions interpreting a book written by hundreds of different people in a language far removed from modern English. He concludes that if you read various passages, including Psalms, and use the Gregorian calendar, which was widely accepted under Pope Gregory, hence Gregorian, in the mid-1500s, and play with some of the words a bit, and then play with them a bit more, and sort of stretch them out a bit, we can be sure that this is a message from God, currently being delivered by making a few eclipses and red moons happen over a period about a year and a half. We should obviously be scared, and we should probably cry, but don't alter your life yet, because it's not clear what the message is, which is weird, because you would think if God exists, he might just interpret this broadcast and maybe interrupt it at some point to announce without all the complications of all this space stuff. Or, you know, he could just use the Pope's Twitter handle. But anyway, let's see what Fox pressed him on.
Now, with all due respect, Pastor, I know that back in 2012 you predicted that there may be the end of the world as we know it, but that didn't happen exactly. So what happens if there's no significant global change that takes place? Will you be disappointed?
Absolutely not. This is a signal that it is going to happen, and that we on planet Earth have been duly notified by heaven that a change is about to happen, and we are to get ready for it. It happened in 1492.
So I don't know quite what we're supposed to do to get ready for it. Do we get under a table or drink heavily? I mean, is that wrong? Feels right. If end times are here. Imagine if this was it. This is the last broadcast. I can't cope with that level of responsibility. I wasn't very good at the beginning, never mind the end of the world. Fox News there, asking no testing questions to a man who was already incorrectly miscalculated the end of the world once and has, unlike science, no proven track record or any knowledge of space and how galaxies work. The sun shall be turned into darkness and the moon into blood before the coming of the great and awesome day of the Lord is apparently a clear signal for all of us. He doesn't give advice on what we should do. But you could buy his book, thereby contributing more money to his net worth of somewhere in the region of $50 million. John Hagee, senior pastor of Cornerstone Church in San Antonio, Texas, CEO of Global Evangelical Television, has made a very comfortable living as a pastor before he converted his non-profit Global Evangelism Television Network into a church, which I didn't know you could do that. Just convert your business into a church. Bonus. But it was actually quite a clever move by the accountants because it relieved him from the obligation to file a publicly available tax return. So no one actually knows how much he makes. But he was known to be the highest paid non-profit executive in San Antonio, making $1 million a year back then in 2004. So I think he's doing all right. I think he might be doing all right. Here's someone that regularly contributes to the pastor. Mohammed, hello.
Hey, Vinny, how are you?
I'm all right.
Listen, the most fascinating thing about this guy is he still collects donations and still went ahead with a knee injury, knowing that he's going to die. You think they don't have surgery in heaven there?
Thank you for your call, yeah. He's also had a heart bypass operation. I think a triple one, actually. And he's still kicking in his mid-70s, but yeah. Weird how someone that believes so heavily in the word of the Lord needs to get scientific medication and various scientifically induced procedures done on his body. But there you go. Now, on a far more interesting take, and I genuinely mean that, I would love to talk to a man who is 44 years old and has been to 195 countries. Yes, pretty much every country. I think the problem is, of course, this is one of the questions I'll ask him, in the time that he was travelling, other countries have been swallowed up and emerged. I'm not sure you can ever genuinely do all of them, but if there's anyone that can get a close as you can possibly be is this man, and we'll speak to him next right here on News Talk 1010.
You're tuned in to the Vinny White Show on In-Depth Radio, News Talk 1010.
Yes, you are, and it's always a pleasure to be here on a Sunday from 9 through till 10. I believe next week I'm filling in for Pei because she's going home to Halifax, so you get a double bubble, double whammy. And so I guess I'll be on from 8 through till 10, which is getting worryingly like a full-length radio show. One of these days, they might even ask me to do that, and I'll tell you what, it's going to be a sham. The reason I get away with this is because you can do pretty much anything an hour and get away with it. Trust me, Pei does the same. She was drunk last week. Come on, she was drinking wine. You can get away with anything an hour. I don't think I don't know. 9:21 is the time. I've been looking forward to this all day. Let me tell you about this guy that we're about to speak to, because I want to big him up, because I'm a reasonably well-travelled man, but my travels pale into insignificance compared to this gentleman. He is possibly, we'll investigate this for sure, if we can, the world's most travelled man. He's 44. He holds the title of the first ever tourist in war-torn Mogadishu. And he's fairly recently unpacked his rucksack after 23 years on the road. Mike Spencer-Bowne has spent 23 years visiting 195-ish countries. The 44-year-old lost count how many times he was arrested on his travels. His last stop was in Ireland some months ago, actually. And one of the reasons I left it a while is because I wanted to see how he was getting used to life back in Canada. He is from Canada and recently moved back. We'll look at a bit more of his travels in a minute. But first of all, let's meet him. Hello, Mike.
Hello.
Nice to speak to you. I've been really excited to speak to you since you got back. When did you get back?
I'm not really sure. It would have been a matter of months ago. I mean, it seemed like it was still kind of sunny and getting a bit colder, so probably
yeah.
Autumn.
What possessed you to arrive back at that time of year? That's surely insanity, isn't it?
Well, I guess I had to do a lot of family visiting.
Mm.
So I've been hanging out with nieces and nephews and all that, and traveling around Canada, making sure I got everyone visited.
Well, I should imagine you had just a little bit to catch up on, like meeting lots of babies that are possibly even teenagers. Tell us a little bit about some of the stuff that you got up to. And let's start at the beginning. No one I've ever met has been travelling for 23 years. Many I've seen with wispy beards walking up the beaches of Thailand looking rather peculiar, and they've been on the road for 3 or 4 years, but no one's ever done 23 years that I've met. What on earth possessed you to do this?
Well, I guess I just got travelling and I liked it so much, I just carried on. I mean, I had the same opinion as you when I was first travelling. You know, I meet someone who'd been on the road for 4 years, and he's been thinking, wow, is that even possible? Or would you go crazy if you travelled so long without stopping? But, yeah, I just found that, with my style of traveling, it was fun enough that I could just keep going.
Well, we should talk about your style of traveling, because most people that you meet, perhaps doing the hostel stuff, tend to visit a place for a couple of days, check into a hostel, get mildly drunk, meet a German, possibly have sex in the bathroom, and then move to the next place. That seems to be the way it works. And good on them, I'm sure. But you don't do it like that. What's your style?
Well, I like, I guess you could call it freestyle traveling. So I like to come in with, you know, almost a little bit of knowledge about the country, but not too much. Hmm. And then just see what happens, because you meet lots of locals or other people who've been there a while, and they suggest things. And if you just let yourself go along with the flow of it, you can have all these really interesting adventures.
Adventures like living with Yakuti tribesmen in the Russian Arctic, visiting the gorillas in Rwanda, trekking along the highest paved road between, I think it connects China and Pakistan, and visiting temples in Japan.
Yeah, but like an example would be for doing the Congo. I'd heard for years that it wasn't possible to do it, because as soon as you arrive, police or rebels or army people would just rob everything you had, and you'd be forced to leave the country.
Mm.
So, I prepared with some fake documents to try to pretend I was a UN inspector and dressed accordingly. And then I just went across the Rwandan-Zodi Mountains by hitchhiking. And the UN at first was trying to stop me and trying to force me to fly to the capital, where, of course, if I did that, I'd miss everything.
Mm.
But I just got out hitchhiking. And I went for, I think it took 3 or 4 days to get over the mountains. And, of course, there were lots of police trying to rob from me. But I was just able to show my fake ID and get through. And then eventually I went by motorcycle for 1,000 kilometers into the jungle. And I met this strange Slovak guy. He's actually quite friendly. But he was out there trying to live with the pygmies and get some photos. So he had an expedition almost already organized. So I just kind of went in with that and out into the jungle living with pygmies. And just things like that happening one after another, just by being completely flexible, you can take advantage of whatever opportunities there are.
You must have, despite your being flexible, you must have had a skeleton plan to be able to tick off all the countries in the world. How did you sort of roughly lay out where you were going next?
I sort of focused on continents. So, when I was doing South America, I was pretty much around there for like 2 or 3 years and got most of it done in that. And Africa, I think, was 3.5 or 4 years, and Asia took an enormous amount of time, so I just kept coming back and doing Asia whenever it seemed like a good season.
You seem a very well-rounded individual, if I may be so bold. I've met some people that have been on the road for a few years, and despite their wonderful life experience, they've also lost grip on reality. You must find it quite hard to know what reality is in many ways. I mean, the concept of you, for example, working in an office, using a computer, dealing with the same people every day. Have you ever even done anything like that?
Not really, no. I have no experience of that, or possessions either. So I only own what fits in one backpack. And it's just a bunch of shabby stuff that if someone stole it, I'd probably be out $100.
This is the same backpack that you left with 23 years ago.
Yeah, same one. It never got stolen. And the shabbier it looks, the least likely, less likely someone's going to steal it, because they'll think it's a local backpack.
Has it got a maple leaf sewn on it?
No, it doesn't.
My goodness, you've broken every rule. You're a maverick.
Well, no, because sometimes I'm trying to impersonate. Like, for instance, I hitchhiked around Iraq during the war, 2003, during Operation Iron Grip. And last thing I'd want is a maple leaf on my backpack.
Yeah.
And I was trying to pretend to be an Iraqi.
I see. So what's the big possession? I mean, let's go, just rewind to the Congo tale you were telling earlier. One of the things that I was thinking is, here you were, with fake identification hitchhiking across the country, a lot of people would draw the line at hitchhiking, never mind the fake ID and putting themselves in a war-torn scenario. What's the motivation behind it? I understand with journalism, they want to develop the story. What's your motivation?
I just wanted to experience, places where other people hadn't been. And it's just so much more interesting if you get out there, tribal people, or going through wildernesses where people hadn't been there in a long time.
Hmm.
And hanging out with the animals. I mean, I used to do a lot of extreme wilderness stuff before I got into the travel. So I used to go, and sometimes, I've gone as long as 86 days without speaking or seeing another person.
No, you haven't, have you?
I have, yeah.
Oh,
I used
man.
To go up in the bush and just live off the land.
That blows my mind.
It's actually quite mind-bending. So it's stronger than any drug you can imagine if you live up there. I mean, there's various effects over time. Like after 10 days, you start to get a bit of time distortion. But after 25, you lose a habit you don't even know you have, which is the habit of compressing your thoughts enough that you can conceptualize them and put them into words.
Well, you actually you kind of lose the ability to speak.
It's more like no thoughts would ever form in the course of a day. And at that point, you really
I knew a girl like that once. I think I went out with her. She was very pretty. But that must be quite worrying. I mean, this, after all, is a technique that's quite often used in Guantanamo, solitary confinement, to make the person be in a panic.
What you do is, as you go in, I'm actually quite good at getting out of that because I'm one for one for getting out of extreme isolation for wilderness. So if I'm in for, let's say, 3 months, I can be normal in 3 months. But it's a lot of work. It's almost equivalent to learning a foreign language, so you got to really work at it. And what you do is, as you lose certain mental attributes and you retune toward the wilderness, you kind of tag them. And I always imagine like a warm shower will be the thing that'll bring me back from it.
And does that work?
It does, yeah. So as I notice, you know, on particular days, usually at 25, 26 days, you lose something. At 45 is another. At 65 is a major one. That's when your self shuts down. So if you only need a self if there's others. And I've never met anyone who can maintain a self past 65 days isolation.
Well, have you met a lot of people that have done this then?
Fair enough. I got crazy friends, right? They're all, they wanted to get me into mountain climbing and stuff like that, which I used to do a lot of it. But there was one time I came back to Vancouver, and my buddy was saying, we need another guy for our mountain climbing team. Mm. I said, I don't know. I used to do that when I was a bit younger. I don't know if I want to get back. And say, why do you need another guy? He goes, we just lost you this weekend.
Oh, great, yeah. Mind you,
no, I'll take a pass.
You've got more lives than your average cat, I would assume. You've had a gun pointed at you a number of times. Maybe you feel somewhat invincible, do you?
Yeah, well, the Americans had arrested me in Iraq once. I was in a prison once. This was in Nagorno-Karabakh, and they thought I was a spy, and they were trying to interrogate me. And the guy was yelling at me in Russian. Like, I had eight guys around me, and I was in a military prison. Mm. The guy was yelling at me, "You will suffer worse than you ever suffered before," and he's yelling this in Russian. And I'm pretending I can't understand any Russian, right? Not even nyet and da. I'm just do-do-do-do-do.
Yeah.
And, eventually they had to bring in a translator. And luckily for me, he was the guy I'd met earlier, because I had wondered what to do in Nagorno-Karabakh, so I'd searched out the only guy who could speak English in the area. And we were kind of friendly, because we've been having tea together, talking about stuff. So when they bring him in as a translator, he sees it's me there. And the guy's yelling again, "You'll suffer worse than you ever suffered before." And then he gives the translation and just, sit tight, he's got to let you go eventually. They were disappointed that I'd gone to the ruined city of Agdan. I think that's what it was, why they were so angry.
Why? What's such a crime about that?
Well, there was a city on the border with Azerbaijan, and I guess there were a lot of Azeris were living there. Mm. And the rumor is that the people of Nagorno-Karabakh massacred the people of that city. So they don't want people going there because I guess they don't want any kind of spotlight.
Oh, I see. Yeah. It's like if you try and on the anniversary of the catastrophe in Tiananmen Square, if you even try and set up a film, you'll just slowly be shooed away.
Yeah, something like that. I mean, I didn't even know about it. It's just that I was hitchhiking and a guy just said, "Do you want to see Agdan?" I'm like, okay.
Yeah. You must be in a situation now with this, purposeful solitary confinement that you put yourself in, the guns that have been pointed, the prisons you've been locked up in, where... And this is, I can't wait to ask this question, where normal life is mind-numbingly boring, isn't it?
Well, I used to think that even before I left for traveling. So when I was in school and all that, it seemed pretty boring to me. That's why I was always going off into the wilderness and living there instead, or thinking of, ways to get away to Central America or places like that.
Which is why when I heard that you were coming home some months ago and you had your final country, which I'm sure you'd been to before, Ireland, you had a pint of Guinness and then headed home to Canada, I knew that you couldn't possibly ever possibly try to get back into whatever is a normal life, in inverted commas. So what's next for Mike Spencer Bown?
Well, I've been trying to... I promised I would do a speech in Calgary, and this is coming up in like 3 weeks. But after that, I've got nothing more that I promised to do, so I'm going to go... I think I'm going to fly over to UK first, because a lot of my friends like to do like free parties and raves and stuff like that, so... I'll see what's going on with that.
Oh, there's life in the old dog, yeah. Are you 45 yet?
Yeah.
Still kicking, aren't you? Oh, why not, for goodness sake, as you should.
Well, it was fun. I used to always arrive in the UK, and usually it was a lot of trouble. Like, often I'd be 9 hours in the detention when I'd arrive there.
Mm.
But because, all these stamps on your passport, they really don't like it, especially Heathrow. Like, I used to sometimes fly into Manchester just because they're just like, look at all the pretty stamps. Stamp your passport and you go, right, get on the train, go to London. Yeah. But if you fly into Heathrow, for me anyway, I had up to 9-hour detention, sometimes 5 or 7.
Well, couldn't you? I suppose it's difficult to come up with a story, isn't it? Because you don't want to get yourself in more hot water. What was the answer when they said, why on earth are you traveling the world like this? What did you say?
Well, I would just say I travel full time, and, you know, I'm just, that's what I do. I drift and go around and around the world. And I think they've got something on my file now, because last time I came in, I was expecting, okay, they're going to, you know, I was through Heathrow, so I thought, all right, they're going to detain me again. But the guy just, first he says, we're going to deport you and all this, and he's getting quite angry. And then he looks at the file and says, oh, actually, Mr. Bowen, welcome to the UK.
Oh, we have changed our tune.
Yeah, so I think there's something on there now.
About time. Well, one of the first questions I had is finance, of course. Now, to travel for 23 years, albeit with one backpack, so not a lot on expenses when it comes to physical objects, it must be phenomenally expensive.
In a way, it is, because certain times you can't resist but to spend $1,000. Like, for instance, let's say if someone says, you know, if you want to, you know, hire this or that, you can go in and actually live with the gorillas in the jungle and see, you know, actual mountain gorillas. Then, of course, I'm going to spend the money. So somehow you have to come up with that extra money.
And where did you get that, for example, $1,000?
I used to do, what's the best way to describe it? I guess I would go
drug
over
dealing?
To Indonesia. And yeah, because it's kind of even an odd job as well. Because, you know, various large people, large companies, including IKEA and others, go over to Indonesia and get stuff manufactured.
Yeah.
Well, what I would do is go over to Indonesia. And I was getting, at that time, a lot of people were buying Indonesian stuff. Mm. And they were shipping it back to Europe or North America or wherever and getting it sold. Mm. And I even talked to a few of them. They said it was a really hard life. Like, you're mostly living in your warehouse. You're barely making a go of it. But I thought, I think that people are not that interested in ethnic-looking stuff. What they want is something that can fit right into their home. So I would take designs. Like, I took one that was an old Scottish wooden box with stylized heather on it. That was from 1,000 years ago. It was dug out of some peat. I just got photos of that from various directions. And I had maybe 50 or 60 other products. And I went out there, and they looked like nothing like Indonesian stuff. But I had them made, and it was quite cheap. You could get something like that made for $7. And I'd find that in a Western country, I could sell it for 42 or 44. Yeah, so I'd go in and wholesale it at flower and garden shows.
Well, you said in an interview famously, I've never had a problem with money. I take calculated risks. I camp, I stay in cheap hotels, I live with the locals and do what they do. It's easy to make money in the third world if you know how, if you've stayed there long enough. I love your optimism, and evidently you do make money and you do manage to succeed, but I'm sure that a lot of people in the third world don't know how to make money.
Oh, yeah, you need to have, because you're actually making the money in the wealthier country. So the third world person themselves is unable to do it.
Yeah.
Like I would notice certain jewelry, and I go, wow, you know, those stones and those jewelry, that's worth a lot in Mexico or something, and that's worth a lot in Europe. And I'd buy it up, and then when I come through, I'd resell it.
If people were listening to this with the same hot feet ready to dive out the door with their passport and fill it full of stamps for the next 23 years, would it be easier now? Because you could say it's easier. You can get from place to place, booking flights on the internet. Or perhaps it would be harder because you couldn't make that money because the internet's made the world smaller.
Yeah, I guess you'd have to think of like a good business idea. It could be harder in a way. But I had an ex-girlfriend, the one I used to do the Indonesian business with. And, you know, I sometimes talk to her on Facebook, but she's making something like $1.5 million a year now. That's what she was telling me anyway. And I can believe it. She's quite a good businesswoman. And she just carried on doing the same thing that we'd done for a little while.
Yeah.
You took it up to the next level, right? Whereas I just took off and just travel, and sort of drained down that little pile of money I had.
I asked people to text their questions in, and I said, please don't text in the question, what's his favorite country? First question, what's your favorite country? So don't blame me. Here it is. What's your favorite country?
Because there's so many. I like the country where, you know, what I have in mind to do. Like, for instance, if I want to, thinking, oh, I really want to climb in the mountains, and I find myself in Nepal, then that's going to be my favorite country.
Yeah,
so it's...
there is no favorite.
I guess here's an unusual one, you know, for food. For the longest time, I thought I had all the different cuisine, you know, of the world. I thought I'd eaten it all. But then I went to Republic of Georgia, and they have something entirely different. And it's basically only the Eastern Europeans know about this, but they have, you know, it's my favorite country for food would be that.
Have you ever tried a whale's penis?
I've had some whale. You know, one time I was in the Faroe Islands, and I got delayed because of fog. And so I got, they actually said a free four-star hotel with a buffet. Okay, so I went and took a bit of everything. And this one thing tastes kind of strange. I couldn't decide if it was beef or it was fish. So I call over a waitress, and what's this? And she says, it's whale. And I go, oh, so I've eaten the controversial, I guess it's not endangered species, but it's kind of controversial.
And what about the Norwegian cuisine, which I believe is fermented whale? Have you ever tried that?
No, I haven't had that. I've had fermented fish in, like, Laos.
Yeah.
Back in the day, they used to have that sort of bamboo fermented fish. They do that in some parts of Indonesia as well.
One of the things I find when I go traveling is and I love it at first, and then I soon hate it if I'm on the road for a few months, is this. When you go to a hostel, the beauty of a hostel, for those that have never stayed in one, is that it's fantastically easy to meet people.
Yeah.
All you have to do is brush your teeth, and sure enough, there's some guy next to you, and he says, "Where are you from?" And you say, "Where are you from?" And he goes, "Oh, I'm from Belgium. I'm a bit bored. Do you want to go for a beer tonight?" And all of a sudden, you've got a buddy. And it really is that simple, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. That's why I always look out for the best common rooms.
As you should, yeah. But one of the things I find a bit frustrating after a couple of months is the usual patter of questions, which goes something like this. What's your name? Vinny. Are you from Australia? That's what, of course, the Americans say. And then I punch them in the face and remind them that I'm from the UK and there is a difference between the accents. And then we move on. And so this goes on for some time. And then, of course, they say, well, where are you going? From Peru, I'm heading north to Colombia. I don't know. And then they say, where have you been? And you find that really, actually, you're having the same conversation with everyone. A very nice one, though, it is. But it gets a pretty boring conversation after a while because it's always the same. You have been traveling for 23 years. What do you do to avert these conversations?
Oh, I find I can just change the conversation just from the very start because I'm not that interested in really just saying where you're from and stuff like that. So I might immediately talk about places I just came from or get right into it. But, you know, I'm willing to endure 5-10 minutes of that if it means that I'll meet up with someone.
But you don't tell people, do you? Because if I met you and I was stuck on a bus, if I had the pleasure of being on a bus with you, then I found out you'd be travelling for 23 years, I would ask you, I don't even know. I wouldn't let you get off the bus. I'm finding it difficult to let you get off this phone. I think it's absolutely fascinating. And I don't think I could stop asking you questions. But how do you avert that all the time? I mean, if you're on the road for that long, you must get people just pissing you off with all these questions.
Well, I'm kind of used to it by now. And sometimes actually I've heard people talking about someone and I find out that it's me. So I've had that sometimes even from different continents, right? Because I've been on the road so much.
Well, so they're like, yeah, I met a guy that was going around the world. It was about 5 years ago. He's Canadian. Nice chap. Well, you hope they say he's a nice chap. You hope they don't say, you know what, I didn't like him.
Yeah, well, it's all good, though. I mean, sometimes you meet people in the strangest place. Like one time, I was about to go into Afghanistan. I was going through Dushanbe in Tajikistan. And I just met this girl who was flying somewhere else. And then later on, I was in, not even that many years ago, I was in Venezuela. I was actually having quite a bit of trouble with the banking there. It was starting to collapse a little bit. But I was just about to go to Angel Falls, and I met the same girl. So, you know, things like that happen sometimes several dozen times. You get strange coincidences, people you met on other continents and unusual places.
And romance?
What's this?
Romance. Are you deliberately avoiding this? Did you have any romances along the way?
Oh, romances. Yeah, I guess more when I was younger, though. I'm almost getting too old.
Don't be so silly.
I mean, they still happen. Oh. I've had had a Kazakhstan girlfriend that I used to travel with a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
I met her. It was quite a romantic meeting because I was in Almaty near the Tian Shan Mountains.
Mm.
And I met this woman who was saying, oh, is a tour going into the mountains? And I was saying, oh, tours, I don't know if that's really my thing. But she says, well, here's the tour. We're getting some watermelons. Okay, it's looking up. And a whole bunch of vodka. Ooh, looks even better. And then we're going to drive up into the mountains where there used to be a Russian observatory.
Mm.
But it was optical, not electronic. It was like one of those big telescopes for viewing galaxies and whatnot. And the Russians had all gone back to their normal place, and they just left this Kazakhstan thing just sitting there.
Mm.
But there's still like the bunk beds where the astronomers used to sleep and all that. So I just went on up there, got drunk, ate watermelons, and it was kind of romantic with the various other Kazakh girls who'd been on the bus because we're all looking at galaxies and everything and getting drunk.
Mm.
So I ended up hooking up with this Kazakh girl. And it turned out to be, even from the point of view of advancing travel, it turned out pretty good because you know, we were together for a few weeks, and then I was off into Uzbekistan to go look at the Aral Sea, where it's, you know, that's that empty sea with the boats just there rusting in the sand. And then I get a email from her saying her boss told her to report to Kabul, but she's too afraid and she's not going to go. And I said, oh, don't tell him that. He'll be angry. You know, how about tell him you will go to Kabul? I'll meet you and we'll go together. And she says, okay, sure enough. And it turned out she had a UN passport. I didn't know too much about her, you know, originally, but she worked for the UN for preventing child labor in Kazakhstan.
Wonderful.
Yeah, but then we head into Kabul together. And once we get in, because she's in the UN, I kind of go into this four-star hotel. Mm. It's since been bombed, but it's like the Intercontinental one. It's on a bit of a hill. But really good security for getting in. And then as soon as we get into our room, she pops open her suitcase, and it's full of vodka and Armenian cognac.
Oh, my God.
Whoa, like, you're not even allowed to have alcohol like this in Afghanistan.
Yeah.
He says, yeah, but I'm UN, so they can't search my passport. I can't search my luggage, right?
Oh, you hit gold with her, didn't you?
Yeah, so we just said, oh, party in our room every night. So as a result, we met all these government officials, because they all wanted to come over and drink booze as well. And ended up running into the Minister for Preventing Corruption, which turned out to be quite amusing later on, because he got invited to this guy's house for a party. And it's actually, the party was downstairs, and he had a swimming pool with mosaics of two dolphins on the floor in his basement. So people splashing around in the swimming pool, and he
had
a bar.
Tacky, a little bit tacky, but I'll let him off.
Yeah, well, you know, it's gabble. So, but there he is behind his bar serving whiskey.
Mm.
And, of course, this is supposed to be illegal. But there's the Minister for Preventing Corruption also getting drunk. And I said, whoa, you're the Minister for Preventing Corruption. And here you are getting drunk in an illegal bar. And he goes, yeah, and I'm smoking Kandahar hashish. And he pulls over something and goes, yeah, so you get funny. So the first few days I was there, you know, I was there with her. So I was meeting a lot of these government officials. And it was, you know, a lot of fun as a result. And then later I went busing into the interior. So
I'm speaking to Mike Spencer Bowne. He spent 23 years visiting 195 countries. And fairly recently returned, and is, let's be honest, not about to hang around for too long. I think do you think the rest of your life might still be on the road in one shape or form?
Well, I guess I can't travel forever, so I'm going to have to think of a new thing to do. I was thinking I might do more like expeditions or something, like maybe more sort of combine the wilderness and the traveling a little bit more so.
As much as we're talking about romance and meeting people, it also must be quite heartbreaking, the amount of people that you've had to say goodbye to along the way, particularly when you're living with tribes and such like. How do you deal with that?
I guess I'm quite used to it. So, you know, I was always using social media as well, so I try to keep in touch with people. And I do occasionally come and meet them again, because I'm just going around and around the world. So every few years I can stop in and see people again. So, you know, I have thousands of friends on Facebook, so it's worked out a little bit better for that. I guess it is a little bit more lonely than what some people have. I mean, I've seen my brothers here now. They're married with kids and all that.
Mm. Well, yeah, but then I'm sure that there's times that they're doing the shopping in Loblaws and the kids are screaming and they think, I really hate Mike and I really wish that I was in Bermuda right now, you know?
But I'm especially bad. Like my older brother, he put this map on the wall and I went over to it and I saw there was 8 little pins in it. And I say, what are these? And he goes, oh, these are the places where, you know, if I get really lucky, I'm hoping I can see them at some time in my life, right? And I said, oh, interesting. Then he went, bing, 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 bing. And I came back a year later and I said, oh, yeah, I just saw those 8 things.
Oh, I hate you. I hate you for doing that. You're crushing the man alive.
Yeah, and so, one of them was South Georgia Island, which was really, that turned out to be quite a highlight, actually.
Where's the most remote place you've ever been?
Yeah, there's so many remote ones. Well, in Mongolia recently, I went into the restricted military zone.
Mm.
And that was pretty remote. I was just riding around. Sometimes you can ride like 70, 80 kilometers a day on horseback. So I rented like a yurt and a horse for $10. And then I just rode around. That was pretty remote. In fact, I saw like some pennants in the distance in this one valley. It was mostly larch trees, but there's a few lakes in it. Mm. And I rode into that valley and I was riding around. And I came up to where the pennants were and I found it was a camp. And there was an extremely elderly French archaeologist came out. He's like older than Gandalf. And he said, are you the National Geographic crew? And I said, no, are you expecting one? And he goes, yeah, I was. You know, we're just about to open the tomb with the Scythian Bronze Age warrior.
Mm.
And I said, oh, I'll hang around for that. Yeah, but that was in the middle of nowhere. Antarctica was pretty remote, but I had to go there with one of these boats that a bunch of you go together and go on.
Was it a scientific expedition boat?
Yeah, well, I ended up stopping over in scientific places where they're studying penguins or studying weather and whatnot.
And of the more developed countries, which I'm sure you find somewhat more boring, frankly, with the stuff that you've seen, have you travelled them much? So, for example, have you been through the States?
I've done, like, not all the States because they're not especially interesting. Mm. Not that they're uninteresting or anything, but I did across the top a few times and down both coasts. Mm. Just a tiny bit of the interior.
What do you do when it comes to the fact that the world's always changing? So it says, I mean, the list of countries is somewhere like 195, which last time I checked is, I think, the amount of countries in the world. But since you've been on the road, there's new creations. Countries are swallowed up. Some are created. For example, South Sudan didn't exist a few years ago.
Yeah,
what do you do about that?
Oh,
you'd already done it, Edgy?
Yeah, I thought that it was going to be a country. So I went in and did it.
You didn't?
Yeah, I've done all the countries and non-countries. I don't know what number to say because I hear numbers as high as 300 And I also hear them as low as 192.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure what the real number is because, you know, according to the United Nations, there's not that many.
There's a website, I think it's called the Centennial Club, forgive me if I'm wrong, but it's full of, it was started by rich Harvard Americans for people that have got to 100 countries. And in their rule of what defines visiting a country, they say quite clearly that if you've gone to the airport, then you've visited the country. How do you feel about that?
I heard about that, and it seems so lame that you know, I never bothered to join in that kind of. It's almost like for people with some sort of mental illness or OCD or something. I don't know what it is, like sticking your foot across the border. It seems kind of odd.
Yeah, you're not really experiencing it, are you?
No, it's like for instance, it used to be that you know I would know what idea you know I had an idea of what countries I've been to, and if people have said, "Have you ever been to South Korea?" I tell them no. But actually, in actual fact, I'd been there twice, but I just stopped off in Seoul. I got a hotel. I walked around a little bit. So I was just saying no. And, of course, you know, I think it was like 2 years ago I went and did it properly. And then I'll say yes. So I think that just sticking your foot across the border or even just a short visit shouldn't really count.
Yeah. Yeah.
You've got to go in and meet the people and see what kind of food they got and see what kind of adventurous things there is to do there.
Speaking of Korea, and we'll probably have to leave it here, but one of the most interesting countries in the world, of course, North Korea. Your thoughts on that? Did you manage to get a tour? Did you manage to leave the tour at any point, or was it all saluting giant bronze statues?
Well, I managed to get on a pretty small tour, but it is you do have to go on a tour unless you want to try to get across the border somehow and get shot at. But it's pretty easy. Just get yourself a double entry China visa. Yeah. And just go to Beijing and go to the downtown. There's an Englishman there who's friends with the dictator. So he's got even the loyalty badge where he's got the dictator's picture on his pin that he wears. And you can't get that unless you're quite good friends with the government, especially for a foreigner. So we can arrange people going in and out. It's like Koryu tours.
Not what you know, who you know, even on the road, eh?
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah, you can just get in that way. And if you're not American, you know, which I'm not and you're not, then you can actually travel on the trains as well.
Wow. Okay. Let me tick off a few slightly less wobbly countries first. It's been an absolute joy speaking to you. I could talk to you all night, but we must push on. Mike Spencer-Bown, possibly, arguably, the world's most travelled man. Thanks for joining us.
Okay. Thank you very much.
See you later.
It's been a pleasure. Bye-bye.
I would encourage you... Sorry, I just pressed the wrong button in excitement. I'd encourage you to look out for his potential forthcoming book. I didn't want to push him on it because I know he hasn't quite got around to starting writing it yet. But when he does, I'm sure it's going to be amazing. And you can be friends with him, should you wish. Join the 2,000 people that are already friends with him on Facebook and follow his adventures. I'm no doubt it's going to continue there. Doesn't feel like he's going to get a small retirement home and take up golf at this point. We'll be back in a minute right here on News Talk 1010.
This is the Vinny White Show on In Depth Radio, News Talk 1010.
You can download this show in a portable format that you can love and hold, although not physically. VinnyWhite.co.uk, VINNEY, white.co.uk, and you can subscribe in iTunes should you feel the need to the podcast that comes out every week. You can take the show with you. And you can join me on Facebook should you feel the need, Vinny White, or Twitter, Vinny White. And I am live every Sunday from 9. Although next week on News Talk 1010, I will be live from downtown Toronto, where we are based. And it might be the last time I'm ever live from this studio. I don't know. I hear we're moving. The whole family are moving down to Queen Street with the Groovy Hipsters. So where I obviously blend in far more because I'm a groovy hipster. No. So I'm not sure when that's going to happen. But regardless, don't worry about it. It's all the same. All sounds the same. And that's, yeah, so next week I'm on from 8 till 10 because I'm covering pay. Good. Now, that chat with that man blew my mind. I loved him. I've got enormous respect for someone that travels as much as him. And if you ever would like to follow his journey, Mike Spencer-Bown, B-O-W-N, is his name. And I want to thank you very much, Mike, for joining us on the radio tonight because although it ran a little bit longer than I wanted it to, I feel that it was well worth running on because you were bloody interesting. Now then, one of the places that gentleman has been is Europe. Europe, the bastion of civilization, home of history and sexy people like me. God, that just didn't flow right. It's a wonderful place, but it has something called the European Parliament. Now, members of the European Parliament have held a rap battle. This sounds good. To engage youth voters in forthcoming elections, it appears. Perhaps we should do the same for the City of Toronto mayoral candidacy. Or perhaps not. Four teams, each made of politicians and professional freestyle hip-hop artists, took to the stage in Brussels to discuss issues that they say matter to young Europeans through rap. Rap, of course, is usually a genre dedicated to talking about how wonderful you are, how many bitches you have, and how much bling you enjoy. But not anymore, not thanks to good old Europe. Well, I'm sure it sounds perfect and wonderful. Let's hear it.
DJ, drop
your mix of noise, everyone!
Yeah! Turn the mic up! That's right, it's the EPP! Everybody's at the BBC! You don't like money, is that what you're telling me? You're only green because you're green with the genocide! That's right, you know you got a vote! We want to create more jobs, so be broke! How you gonna live if you don't try? Everybody knows without work you will die! That's okay, don't open the border, it's not a solution. We need to stop all the slaughter, the order is to create more discussion. Everybody knows that the time is rushing towards a new place. EU needs to be stronger, that's why we need to create longer legislation so we can work the nation. Everybody knows there's no intimidation, but the truth is we need solutions. No disputing, we need a fiscal union.
Right. I love that, stop that. That's the first time that line's ever been used in any rap track. No disputing, we need a fiscal union. Aye, hear me. Word up to the Mother Hubbards in Brussels. I'll read. Vote for the EPP if you want money, said the European People's Party at the start of round one. It went on and towards the end sounded like this.
Can anybody hear me?
Sadly, we can, yes.
Yeah.
This guy's
first
from Belgium.
Of all, I'm the only Belgian in here.
Yes.
Just want to know I don't do it for the Belgians in here.
Yes.
I'm recording in here.
Nice.
I'm in the Matrix. They just brought Morpheus here.
Okay. Not sure what that was about.
Politics. Never on some god shit. But hey,
sadly, yeah, we'll have to leave it there because we've only got 20 seconds left of the show, which is a shame because I'm sure that was possibly the best thing that's ever been played on radio. Sorry, did I say best? I meant most horrific in every possible sense. A little piece of me has died inside. I hope you're still alive. See you next week at 8.